I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. We've just released our third update to the Deaths Inside database, which tracks the deaths of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in police and prison custody. It finds 474 people have died in the 30 years since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. Today, I'm talking to Head of News Mike Tisher and Indigenous Affairs Editor Lorena Allam about why Aboriginal people are still dying in such large numbers and what needs to change now. It's Friday, the 9th of April. Lorena, you're a seasoned guest of Full Story, but this is your debut on a Newsroom Edition, so welcome.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So Guardian Australia has today released its third update of the Deaths Inside database. Lorena, why are we doing this?
We started this project in 2018 to get a sense of how many Aboriginal people have been dying in police and prison custody since the Royal Commission in 1991. Now, that information is surprisingly hard to find. While the Institute of Criminology does track deaths in custody, their figures once released for various, you know, important reasons are often out of date. So what we wanted to do was get a real-time figure of how many Aboriginal people were in custody. In order to find that figure, we realised we would have to collate it ourselves because there are no jurisdictions, state, territory or federal, who are tracking this in real time.
And Mike, you know, you've been at The Guardian since the beginning. Was reporting on Indigenous affairs always a priority for The Guardian?
I've been at Guardian Australia since the beginning, yes.
Not 200 years of The Guardian, sorry. You're not that old.
Yes, so Indigenous affairs was one of the five key core areas that Guardian Australia decided it would concentrate on when it began in 2013. And obviously the work that Lorena and others have done around collating deaths in custody has been a hugely important part of that in recent years. And I think we should stress that was one of the recommendations of the 1991 Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, was to maintain a watching brief on deaths in custody through transparent reporting and annual monitoring. So that has not been done effectively, and that's the main reason why The Guardian decided that we should to do that to the greatest extent possible for a media organisation.
And it is important to point out we are a media organisation. We're not criminologists. We're not academics. This is not our field of expertise. We saw a gap in public knowledge, a really significant gap in public knowledge about something that people really ought to know about, and decided to address it.
So what has this update found? What are the key findings that we're releasing today?
Well, the crucial thing is the number of Aboriginal people who have died in custody since 1991 is now at 474. Mm-hmm. That's at least 474 people. We're not saying that they have all died in suspicious circumstances or that they have died at the hands of the state, but they have died in custody nonetheless. And when we track their deaths, we track particular data points, so things like whether they received the care that they needed, whether there was force used in their arrest and detention, whether they had pre-existing medical and mental health conditions. Mm-hmm. So we are able to provide a good picture of each of those people and what they experienced in the events leading up to their death.
I think the data is more relevant, well, seems more relevant than ever, given the quite a significant number of recent cases of deaths in custody we've experienced. Can you tell us what's happened just in the last few months?
So at least five deaths have happened since the beginning of March this year. Two of those deaths we would not have known about had it not been for questioning of the New South Wales Police Commissioner Peter Severin in a parliamentary hearing a few weeks ago. So when Mike mentioned earlier the transparency and accountability around reporting of deaths in custody, this is a good example of why people were so concerned about this 30 years ago, that we wouldn't have known about these two people dying had it not been for questioning in a parliamentary hearing. So there have been five since the beginning of March. What we also found that was interesting was that in 2019, there were 4 Aboriginal people shot dead by police and corrections officers. We're not saying that all those deaths are connected. They're not. But it's the highest number of Aboriginal people dying of shooting deaths at the hands of corrections since the records began in 1991. And the most significant thing about that is that 2 of those cases have resulted in police officers facing murder charges and the other one facing a manslaughter charge. It's the first time ever that there have been criminal proceedings ensuing from a death in custody.
Why? Why is this the first time? Is there any evidence or anything to tell us why this is happening now?
It's hard to say based on our research what the evidence is, but certainly people have told us that they think that the attention that's been placed on this issue by the Black Lives Matter movement calling for greater accountability may have had something to do with that.
And I just want to go back to the media reporting for a minute, because it's something you and Mike have both mentioned. Mike, you've been in Australian media since the 1991 Royal Commission. Has media reporting changed, or do you think media reporting can change attitudes?
Well, it certainly can change attitudes. I think that it's fair to say there have been some changes. Hopefully Guardian have been part of some of the more positive ones. A small example, perhaps, it's much more common now for media, at least some media, to refer to Indigenous people's country when they introduce them, where they come from in their terms, not just in sort of traditional media terms. I think that's one example of where there has been a change in language, at least, but that's not universal by any means. And in terms of reporting of crime, that is still extremely problematic in many cases. I think we've seen still way too many examples of where politicians have been able to run a tough-on-crime line with the, I wouldn't say collaboration, but media are very willing to accept that line very often and to run their own campaigns against crime, in inverted commas. Just to give a couple of examples, perhaps last year in the Queensland election campaign, there was a huge fuss in Townsville, partly involving reporting by the local paper, the Townsville Bulletin, about how terrible crime was in Townsville. There was a lot of exaggeration about the extent of crime, mainly involved Indigenous people, and all the parties basically involved in the election campaign, Labor, Liberals, One Nation, Katters, etc., they all came out with variations on tough and crime policies, particularly to clamp down on young offenders. And we know that those kind of policies that target relatively minor offences are exactly the ones that bring people into contact with the criminal justice system at an early age.
I see you nodding along, Lorena.
No, it's true. It's quite right what Mike's just said. I mean, here in New South Wales, there was a study done of 500,000 police bail decisions where they found that police were far less likely to give Aboriginal people bail for really minor offences. And we hear time and again that the discretionary powers that police have to strip search and detain people are disproportionately used against Indigenous people. And that's can often be a trigger for a lifetime of contact with the criminal justice system. The use of police summary offences, particularly against young people. I mean, the frustrating thing, I think, is that 30 years ago, the Royal Commission report described this exact situation. Mm. It said a major reason for Aboriginal deaths in custody remains the grossly disproportionate rates at which Aboriginal people are taken into custody, of the order of more than 20 times the rate of non-Indigenous people. So that was what was said 30 years ago. Very little has changed on the face of it since then.
Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, critics seem to say is that, oh, but more white people die in police custody. Lorena, can you do a bit of a fact check on these claims for us, please?
I mean, that's true. That's true. More white people do die in police and prison custody because their population is bigger. Mm. But as a proportion of the prison population, Aboriginal people die at a much higher rate. So Aboriginal people are dying at higher rates in custody than non-Indigenous people because Aboriginal people are disproportionately arrested, remanded and jailed. And so they die at higher rates in custody as a proportion of the total population.
So, Lorena, you've got 10 years of data comparing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander deaths in custody to those of non-Indigenous people. What have been the key findings in that comparison?
Yeah, so we did study this comparatively because we wanted to be able to show people. We wanted to illustrate that point that I just explained. And so when you compare the two populations, we found that Aboriginal people who died in custody were more likely to have not been charged with a crime, meaning they were on remand or in protective custody or being arrested or being pursued. So that was more than half of all the cases, whereas for non-Indigenous people, it was 45% of all deaths in custody. For non-Indigenous and Indigenous people alike, the most common cause of death was medical issues, followed by self-harm. But Indigenous people who died in custody, we found, were much less likely to get the medical care they needed than non-Indigenous people. We also found that women, Indigenous women, were much less likely to have received all appropriate medical care prior to their deaths compared to men. And the final thing was, I guess, we found that agencies like police watch houses, prisons and hospitals failed to follow all of their own procedures in 43% of cases where Indigenous people died, compared to 19% of cases where non-Indigenous people died. I just want to say too that that also is exacerbated by the fact that for the last 30 years we've had a Royal Commission series of recommendations that are designed to prevent that from happening. So the fact that there's such a disparity and people are still dying in those circumstances is, it's really hard to understand why.
So why is nothing, or why is so little being done about this over-incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
I think perhaps one reason is that it takes place against a backdrop of over-incarceration generally. We were putting a lot more people in prison across the entire population. In the 10 years before 2019, it rose from 170 per 100,000 to 221 per 100,000 of the population, and that's way above the OECD average for rates of imprisonment. But the rise was even more pronounced among Indigenous people. So, and also women were overrepresented in the recent rise. So I think one reason is that it's not taken into account when decisions are made that result in general over-incarceration. It's just not considered because it's a political playbook that works generally well. No one is going to argue against being tough on crime in an election. It's very hard to make that argument in many cases. And so it's just not something that gains traction politically.
In 2019, a Deloitte's report was released that assessed how governments were going in terms of implementing the Royal Commission recommendations. And they found that, you know, over 60% of these recommendations had been fully implemented, and a very low, I think 16% had not been implemented. And they said that was a pretty good result. Mm. However, in the wake of the release of that report, 33 academics in Australia wrote an open letter to the government saying that that report was overly positive and didn't take into account really important sustained changes. And an example of what they might mean is that we just heard of a death in custody in Queensland of a person who used a hanging point that the Royal Commission recommended be removed 3 decades ago.
Oh.
So it is very much what Mike's saying, that there's this, that being tough on crime is a vote winner, and it has ever been thus, and it has always been that way. The kind of reforms that are needed to reduce Aboriginal deaths in custody aren't attractive to governments, even though they are effective on a social and an economic level. Things like justice reinvestment, things like amending bail legislation. These are all things that have been recommended since the Royal Commission as potential ways to reduce the numbers of people, Aboriginal people, going into custody. But they don't seem to get much traction with politicians. It's so much easier to look like a tough guy when it comes to crime.
I think bail is particularly difficult because no politician wants to be the one who has to answer to the media when someone who's on bail commits a terrible crime, as we've seen many cases of, even if that represents a statistically very low proportion of people who are on bail. But in many other respects, the recommendations are not that controversial to implement. No one is going to make a controversial issue out of removing ligature points from jail cells or you would think, from jailing fewer people for non-payment of fines, which is another large cohort of people, particularly women in some states who are in custody. There are many things that could be done without raising political controversy, and I think that's more damning in a way that even the relatively painless things have not been done in all cases.
I think the elephant in the room is systemic racism. You know, I think there's this assumption that we belong behind bars. That we are an inherently criminal people. I mean, the Uluru Statement from the Heart refers to this. We are not an inherently criminal people. And yet this assumption remains that we are. Whereas time and time again, we have seen with the cases that we've read in the database, people are dying because of systemic neglect. I mean, if you look at the arc of an Aboriginal person's life, as we've done hundreds and hundreds of them, Aboriginal people are going into jail for really minor offences, and a series of minor offences that have begun from a young age. They often come with intergenerational trauma. They come with unaddressed mental health issues. These are medical problems. These are social and emotional and medical problems. They are not, people are being criminalised for having a really difficult life. Once people get to jail, their treatment can be quite poor. And if you're Aboriginal and you come into jail with a number of complex health problems, you can get sicker and die. Like in the case of 36-year-old Nathan Reynolds, who died gasping for breath on the floor of a prison from an asthma attack. The coroner found in his case he was deprived of some chance of surviving by the unreasonably delayed response to his emergency by prison guards and health staff. But the problems went back to much earlier on. Like when he was taken in as a prisoner, there was a very clear note on his file that he was an asthmatic, but his needs were never met. The assessments were never made, and he consequently died of a massive asthma attack. So this is what I mean about systemic failings and neglect that disproportionately affect Aboriginal people.
And programs like Just Reinvest, it's baffling to me to understand why that's not taken up, when not only does it save human misery, but it saves money too. Can you tell us what's happened with that program in Bourke?
Well, people might think these things are not connected, but they actually are. So when you're trying to divert Aboriginal kids away from the criminal justice system, you have to start young. In Bourke in Western New South Wales, they looked at the stats and they discovered that kids were coming into contact with the police and, you know, being picked up for being unlicensed drivers. So the solution was to teach them how to drive. And the police were enlisted in teaching kids how to drive. So not only did they help reduce the number of kids getting busted for not being licensed, it actually improved relations between the police and Aboriginal kids because they're sitting in the car together. So these are things that can happen. This saves money because kids aren't, you know, taking up the resources of Aboriginal and legal aid services. People aren't going behind bars, and we're not spending money on juvenile detention that we could spend on, you know, more teachers in the local primary school. So this is why, this is the economic cost of not addressing these problems at their heart.
Yeah, if people don't respond on a human level to deaths in custody, maybe they can respond on an economic level, because it's fantastically expensive to keep people in prison. We're spending nearly $5 billion a year, according to the Productivity Commission, on incarcerating people. And as many people will know, pretty much every juvenile incarcerated in the Northern Territory is Indigenous. If we can address that in some way, they could basically stop incarcerating people at all in the Northern Territory and save a lot of money, as well as improving those kids' lives. So there is just no good argument for not doing that.
Lorena, do you think there's political will to make the changes we need?
No, I don't. I really don't. And I say that because, look, I genuinely think political will exists when politicians realise that the people want something and it is in their best interests to provide it. So that is why people are out on the streets marching for Black Lives Matter, and why it's having an impact is that people are starting to see that this is a movement that wants change. And it's sad to say that 30 years down the track, people are back out in the streets protesting the same thing, but perhaps that's what it's going to take. I think it's a situation now 30 years down the track that's really crying out for some political leadership. Mm. And there is an opportunity here for somebody to take up this cause and you know, create some reform.
For a politician, for an aspiring leader, what a legacy would be to leave. How greatly would it burnish their reputation to say, I was the person who actually finally did something about this festering problem in Australian public life. And, just waiting for that person.
Mm. I mean, none of us want our kids to be sitting here talking about this when it's their turn. And where the solutions are already in front of us. It's not like they have to go and find the answers. The answers are already there.
If this episode has raised any issues for you, Australia's Crisis Support Service Lifeline can be contacted on 13 11 14. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Ryan Pemberton, the executive producers are Mars Martignoni, and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a lovely weekend. And Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday.